Oh, okay. Well, my name is Malcolm Phillips. I'm originally from South Africa, city called Durban. I've been living in the United States for just a little over 40 years. I arrived here for a vacation for 6 months, and that was it. I guess that happens to most people that come out to Southern California.
Imagine leaving your family and friends behind to immigrate to the United States to set up a life, and along the way you become a dealer, and you become a dealer for the next 30 plus years. And eventually you get to the point where Malcolm Phillips of Phillips Auto is able to turn over his business to his employees and entrust in them that what he's built over the last 30 some odd years, they will be able to carry on his legacy.
Malcolm has built a successful business based on relationships, but it's been challenging along the way as the internet has progressed and taken away the need for relationships in some respects in the car buying process. But even through all of that, Malcolm has persisted in maintaining his relationships, building a successful business, and gotten to the point where he can even step away for a period of time and still see his dealership running successfully.
And as he will share with you, he went from stock number one, which represents the first car he ever had in stock, to 37,000. So let that sink in for a little bit. I'm Dennis Wisco.
And I'm Kelly Cruz.
And this is the Wisco Weekly Podcast in our special podcast series, Dealer Exec Customer X, where dealer executives share how their dealership operation aligns with the customer experience.
You are now tuned in to the Wisco Weekly Experience.
Chicken brown cow. Listeners, welcome to another episode of Wisco Weekly in our special podcast series, Dealer Exec Customer X, where I get the opportunity to hang out and chat with dealer executives, and they get to talk about how their operation aligns with the customer experience. And I'm recording from Newport Beach, California, and listeners, please welcome to the show owner of Phillips Auto, Mr. Malcolm Phillips. Malcolm, how are you, sir?
Wonderful, Dennis. Thank you very much for inviting me to your show.
I appreciate you being on here. So, Malcolm, I want to get into this here real quick, just because you run, from everything that I've kind of researched and gathered about your operation, you run a pretty tight ship. And I think one of the things that's been most impressive to me is when I've had the chance to look at all the cars that you've had in stock and take a look at the Carfaxes of all the cars, you consistently have cars that do carry a good history on their Carfax. They seem to be all born and bred in California. And I know you've been in the business for 30 plus years. And so one of the things I'm most curious about then is how do you, you know, with all the time you've spent in the business, how does someone like you, how do you select your cars for your customers? How do you pick out your, you know, your auction cars, your trading cars, and then you eventually retail them? Can you walk me through that?
Oh, well, absolutely. Well, that's the biggest challenge in our industry is the acquisition of the vehicle. You know, we come from a very diversified country with different weather conditions. And I've always been very pro-California, dry weather. So being located in Newport Beach, which is rather affluent area, there are people that have numerous cars that have gated communities, you know, air-conditioned storage on their cars. So I'm blessed to have the opportunity to purchase and consign some of the best cars in the country, as far as I'm concerned. Basically, what we do is we are an acquisitions business, and I started out the company in 1984 as basically a wholesaler. I was running a Porsche dealership up in Buena Park, California, back in the early 80s, and realized that I needed to be on my own. So what I decided to do was get my dealer license, and I think at the time, 1984, I started with $50,000, and I set sail and started banging on doors of all car dealerships. In the old days, that was the way to buy your cars. You would go to a BMW dealer and purchase a Mercedes, because at that time they didn't have the technology at their fingertips to really know what the value of that car was. So they needed a middleman to basically walk them through the process. So I then would make a relationship with a Mercedes store, who I would in turn take that Mercedes trade from the BMW door, and vice versa. So that's how it all started. And I wasn't really concerned about retail. I'd been doing retail for 8 years prior to that and got a little burnt out from the sales side of it. And I just wanted to really get into the wholesale business. But realizing that I was getting such incredibly gorgeous cars from all my local contacts in Newport Beach and all the dealers locally, that I decided that, you know, maybe it's time to open a retail facility. And I did this in the latter part of the 80s. And at that time, you know, we were still without the internet, basically, and we were relying on paper, LA Times, Auto Trader magazines and such. So people,
for advertising,
for all your advertising to sell the cars. So I just sort of got a little niche business going there, and I bought all my cars in a beautiful warehouse, and I painted the walls wholesale to the public, and that's how it all started. And I used to buy these really high mileage, clean cars that I obviously could sell at a very good price because of the high mileage. And the fact that I didn't have a lot of money to buy expensive cars, I would buy a lot of Mercedes diesels. And as we well know, those cars would do in excess of 200,000 miles, and the cars were built differently in those days. And so I basically used to advertise these cars at the lowest prices without disclosing the mileage on these cars. And I would want the people to call in so I could at least tell them more about the vehicle and try and, you know, get their attention and hopefully get their business to, you know, trust a Mercedes with 200,000 miles at 50% of the price of one with maybe 70,000 miles. So that's how it all started. And then I moved into Newport Beach. That was up in Santa Ana in a warehouse. And I moved to Newport Beach close to 20 years ago and tried to use that same philosophy, but it didn't work down here. I realized that I was in a more affluent area. People had money to spend, and they obviously, it was the car capital of probably, for, as far as Mercedes-Benz goes, I know they had the largest Mercedes-Benz dealership for the last 15 years in Newport Beach, and Porsches and Mercedes were just, you know, rolling around the streets here like Toyotas would in Los Angeles. So I sort of focused more on the Porsche market, and actually with the help of a banker, got a little flooring line, and I set sail and started hitting all my dealerships that I had built these relationships with and became a really big Porsche buyer. I hired buyers, and my business was basically then set up as an acquisitions business. And the beauty of the acquisition side of it and being in retail and wholesale, I didn't really need to depend on going to an auction to buy my product, because auctions are really, and I hate to run down auctions because I make a good living out of auctions, but it's for the less discriminating dealer, I feel, or the dealer that doesn't have the ability to buy the cars and he has no other option but go to the auction. The quality of the cars are much greater today, and there's condition reports and there's inspections, so buyers are rest assured they can buy a good product at the auction. But unfortunately, they've got to pay a lot of money to get that car because they're competing with a vast number of internet buyers, and which takes all the fun out of trying to retail a car when you're paying too much for it wholesale, because you know you have to mark it up so much, and consequently you're pricing yourself out of the market. So I focused on acquiring cars directly from dealers and the public, especially in the area that I am located. And I, as I said earlier, that we do a lot of consignments. So now the vehicle, we acquire the vehicle, but that doesn't mean to say we're necessarily going to retail it. We have a really, really stringent 100-point inspection on the cars. I personally inspect every car myself.
That's all done on site then?
That's all done on site. I look at those cars, I check the Carfax reports, making sure these cars haven't been in accidents. I scrutinize them. I look at where they've had their life. They've been California bred and lived here most of their life. I look for telltale signs. You know, when I'm looking at a car, you can just tell by the wear and tear of the back seat. If kids have been in there, obviously there's more wear and tear on a vehicle if you've had it for the children. And, you know, I just look at the car really closely. And I've had a mechanic now for 15 years who I trust explicitly with checking out my cars, and he and I think alike, and we put my seal of approval on it, and then we move forward and we advertise it for retail. And we do that mostly now. We've dropped all our paper advertising. Everything is done through the internet. So the key here is making the job easier for the salesman by giving them a product that sells itself, basically. So
If I understand then, so based on your years in the business and the relationships you've been able to form with dealerships and kind of avoiding the auctions and what, you know, the fact that there's not as much quality control coming out of the auction. So therefore, when you're going directly to the dealers, you have a more discerning eye. This is how you're selecting your cars to put on your lot.
For the most part, that is very correct, yes. So it's a combination of the dealers and then directly from the public, because, again, as I was saying, you know, the consignment business, we've had a consignment program going for, you know, 20 years right now. We were one of the first dealers to implement it. There are other dealers doing it today. But quite honestly, I don't think anyone comes close to how we process the vehicle to getting it out there, and our turn ratio is extremely high. We turn our cars every 45 days. So that's,
well, that's impressive, especially with the nature of cars and just in general, the competitive markets landscape, you know, the fact that you're retailing Bentleys and Aston Martins and Maseratis, and there's, you know, the franchise operations are just down the street. So that is very impressive. You having 30 plus years of experience in the business, and you've incurred so many battle wounds. Also, you were born and raised in South Africa, in which, as you had mentioned earlier, there were some politics that you didn't agree with, and so you left the country. But if you were to look back through your entire life so far, were there any defining moments for you in which helped shape your business till this day? You know, was there a defining moment that gave you this, either, you know, this you know, in what in Jewish they call it chutzpah, but you know, something of that nature that you've taken till this day?
Well, you know, I think it's really about where you all, how your journey starts, you know. And I think being living in South Africa, and I came from a sort of a middle class family. That my dad was a working class father who had a recapping business, and he liked to have a bet on the horses and have a beer with his mates at night. My mother was always worried and struggled, as a woman would from that generation, who she never drove a car or wrote a check in her life, so she's extremely dependent on my dad, and she was always panicked about not having enough money to buy food the next day, just with my dad's habits. So, you know, I kind of concerned myself about it, and I become a bit of a worrisome person. And I at a very young age, my life was soccer. I played soccer from a young age. I think I woke up with a soccer ball next to my crate when I was born. And, you know, back in South Africa, during the growing up in the 50s and 60s, we didn't even have television. So playing was just outside. We'd get a ball and we'd play, and then we'd go inside and listen to the radio at night. But as a young kid, I started working, and I learned about business from a young age. I surrounded myself with sports players. I worked at a sports shop pumping soccer balls and going to the local Hot Rod Stadium and selling programs, and then getting promoted to a ticket seller, and then just coming out of high school and going straight into the military in South Africa, which was mandatory in those days, that every white kid that grew up in South Africa turned 18 years old, he would have to have a stint in the military. This is during the days of apartheid, and that was a year in the army, and, you know, discipline. And then traveling abroad with very little money and just a backpack on my back, and acquiring a Volkswagen Combi in Spain and hitching up with three other guys and, you know, traveling around and living for 4 years in Europe and actually affording to come to America with, even though I still had $50 left on a $2,000 journey and I saw every city in Europe. But it was just hustling. When I say hustling, I mean it in a positive way. Just knowing that you had to go out there and make it work, because you know what? There was no handouts. There was just no entitlement. You had to really earn it. And you appreciate the dollar when you earn it yourself. And I think coming over here, you know, having no idea the front from the back of an automobile, it was the least interest in my mind, because, you know, cars were not a big thing in South Africa. They were extremely expensive. And, you know, coming over here, I just realized that, you know, I knew how to sell. And somebody had mentioned to me after a little short stint in selling clothing that go out and go to get a job in the car business. You're a young guy that, you know, connects with people. So, you know, I walked the streets. It was very difficult, but I met a guy who thought my accent would sell cars. So he hired me at a Volkswagen store up in...
And your good looks.
Well, thank you. Well, he hired me and back in 1977, I was 26 years old, and it was just during the end of the buggy era. And anyway, I got in there on the 13th of April, 1977, and those days, car salesmen would have demos because that was just part of the job. It was quite a prestigious job to have in those days, to be a car salesman, because the it was a pretty well-paid job, and I was fortunate to get it. And I remember we had a franchise selling Volkswagens and Alfa Romeos, and Alfas had just been re-released in 77 because they couldn't get them to pass all the emissions in 75 and 76, which was a real problem with the Giulia and the GT and the sedan they had. And then they reintroduced the Spider from a few years of rest. But anyway, I remember we had a few on our lot, and very difficult to sell those cars, and they needed to be driven, otherwise they would just rot on the lot, you know. So I remember my manager saying to me, you know, I'll hire you, but I won't give you a demo. I said, fair enough, I don't deserve it. You don't know anything, I have no track record. And I said, I'm fine driving my 67 Plymouth Valiant that I had acquired for $400 after my second paycheck selling clothing. And anyway, I said, well, let's make it fun. After my first day at work, on the 13th of April, 77, I sold two cars. I sold a Volkswagen Dasher that was sitting up on the special rack that I had to jump start it. I thought it was a taxi up there. It was that bright yellow color. It was a four-door stick shift. And, you know, it's four-door stick shifts weren't really the car of choice. And this car, the tires were a little bit flat. But I had this couple, and I love to tell the story because it really is what made me feel, gave me the confidence that I could do it, you know. And and this guy, I said him straight out, I said, where's the battery on this car? And he said, it's in the engine compartment. So we popped the engine compartment over. I had a lot attendant jump it, which I wouldn't have known negative from positive pole in those days. And we jumped it. He helped me take it off the rack. And I sat in the back seat, and this guy and his wife or girlfriend, I can't remember, went for a test drive, and I told them all about my journey and that they were my first up, and wouldn't it be amazing if they bought this car? And I think they bought it just because they wanted to hear my story, you know. And so anyway, later that day, I got a little cocky, and there was a guy driving through, and interesting enough, I didn't know anything about TV. He was on a TV show, and I'm trying to think. I think it was Larry Wilcox. He was on a TV show that was called Cops, I think, or it was two police guys. I can't remember.
Chips?
What, sorry?
Chips?
Chips. No, was it? Yeah, it was Chips, I think.
Yeah.
Yep, so he came in. He had a cowboy hat on. They'd been shooting down in San Clemente, and they were driving up on the 5 freeway, and they exited at Manchester, and we had a Scirocco, a Volkswagen Scirocco, just came in on the showroom floor, and he had this beautiful woman with him, and I didn't know if it was his wife or his girlfriend. And he came in there, and we started chatting, and there was no discount on that car, and he bought the car, and my voucher was $400, and I got really, really, I think I got a $300 voucher on the Dasher for being the oldest car in stock. It was a flat fee, and $400 commission on the Scirocco. So I had $700 made. I think it was my best month I ever made was probably around 650 to 7 prior to that. So my arrogance kicked in, which was a good arrogance, and I went to my manager and I said, make me fight for something to get a demo at the end of the month. He looked at me and
he said, say that again?
I wanted a demo at the end of that month because it was the 13th, and I didn't want to drive this Valiant because all these, my co-workers were driving Rabbits and Dashes and Sciroccos. He said, okay. He said, if you finish in the first three, and we only had five salesmen, but keep in mind it was the 13th of the month and I had just got two cars out. And I think the bottom guy had about four out, so there was definitely something I could chase for. And he said, I remember that he said, if you get in the top three, he said, you'll get a demo. I said, what if I ended up number one? He said, well, then you could have any demo you like. I said, could I take the Spider? They need to be driven. He said, you can have a Spider, with a giggle, not thinking anything would make come of this. Well, I worked. I took my 2 days off the next week, and I said, can I come in? I had appointments set up. I came in, and I worked, and I sold cars, and I sold cars. And it was the last day of the month, and I was a 1.5 cars behind a guy that took off. It was his day off. He didn't come to work. There wasn't really much motivation for him to be there. There might have been a small bonus.
He didn't know about your bet either. Or did he know about your bet?
I kept that private because, you know, I was new and I didn't want to be too arrogant and cocky. And I was trying to befriend all these guys. And I just kept it to myself. But I ended up selling two cars on the last day of the month and ended up being number one and picked out my ivory tan top Palomino Interior 77 Alpha GT.
Nice.
And I was a stud. And boy, oh boy, I needed that car because all I'd worked, I was working and I didn't have a girlfriend at the time. But, you know, I realized it didn't take long to find a girl when you're driving a Spider. So so then my life was made. And then I just decided that, you know, this is fun, but I wanted more and more. And I then worked my way up to being, I think I was only there for about 2 years. And then, you know, the Volkswagen died at 79 was the last year of the Bug convertible. And the Rabbit was in power, but Volkswagen started slipping and the Japanese started making a move in 1979, 1980. Mazda came out with a rotary engined RX-7 that was the big hit. So our company had another dealership in Costa Mesa, which is a Norm's restaurant on Harbor Boulevard today, but there used to be a dealership called Miracle Mazda. Mm-hmm. And we had a pickup truck, I think it was a B200 or 2000, and we had the RX-3 or 4, a couple of those rotary engines in that RX-7. And I asked for a transfer down there, and I got the transfer, and I worked down there for a year, and then the old general manager called me up and he said, would you consider coming back here if I made you the used car manager? And we're getting Porsche from next door. They're going to mix Porsche with Volkswagen and we're dropping Alpha. I said, I'm in. And that was my journey. And I actually went back there. And I used to fly over to Texas back in the early 80s when I was managing and buy truckloads of Volkswagen Bugs because there were none around there. And we used to buy them at the auctions out there. They were little rust buckets, but we'd fix them up in our body shop, and we were selling them on the lot, and that was our big seller. So
how did you come to find that there was this pot of gold of Volkswagens in Texas?
Well, you know, Californians loved the Bug. You know, it was a big, you know, and I just, you know, just by talking to the factory reps and how we were doing and, you know, how do I get more Bugs? Because, you know, the store had never really worked on trying to sell more than 20 cars a month, and we had a lot that could hold 50. And I thought, well, you know, that does. If you got 50, why can't we sell 50? You know, I mean, as long as we have a funnel where we could replace what we sell, you know, and you know, just I can't remember exactly, but you know, Texas wasn't that. You know, they liked the big cars back then. You know, gas was fairly reasonable.
Well, even till this day, they do.
Yeah, they do, right? So those Bugs, and they rusted real bad. The floorboards used to rust. But, you know, we used to put little plates at the bottom and re-carpet them. You could redo a Bug cheap, you know, put a new carpet kit in, redo it. And, you know, put them on the lot there. They were selling, I think, you know, in the early 80s for the price, you know, $39.95 for a, you know, like a 74 bug would be, you know, $4,000 back in the early 80s. So especially the Super Beetles, and then the 67s became. So all those bugs became really popular cars. And, you know, there wasn't enough Porsches out there to sell that many in those days, you know. But boy, I wouldn't mind a few of those Porsches today that we sold then. They are worth a fortune today.
I'm sure. Hell yeah.
But I think that's how it started. And then I remember looking at wholesalers coming in. They would come in flip-flops and short pants on a hot day, and they would sort of buy these trade-ins that we had. And I thought they were just like doing me a big favor, you know, buying these Toyota Corollas that would come in. And then I got a little snoopy to find out what they did with them. And that all led its way to that auction that I talked about, which was very small in those days. You know, there was no online bidders, and there was no internet sellers, and there was no technology. There was just a little piece of paper you'd get at the end of the beginning of the next sale for what the results were from the prior sale. And these guys, you know, if you had a good memory and you knew how to titivate a car, you know, just give it a little clean and wax and put it in the auction, you know, make $300-$400, and they would go to dealers and buy cars. So I liked that idea, so I approached one of them and I asked him if I could work through his license and pay him a fee and use his money, and he agreed to do that. So I did that for about 3 months, and then that took me to 1984 when Phillips Auto was created. I went out and got a dealer license and started wholesaling for, like I say, and got familiar, because in order to be a successful retail operator, to anyone that's thinking about opening a pre-owned dealership, my advice is learn how to buy cars.
You've been involved in your business through several different facets, and obviously there are things that you enjoy more so than others. But at the end of the day, because your name is on the building and you have all this knowledge of how best to sell cars, to acquire cars, obviously the unifying factor is you. What happens when you're not in the equation anymore with your dealership? I mean, I guess this kind of gets down
well,
to like...
Well, you know, that's a very good question, and it's a very relieving question, because, you know, as you know, I've been doing this since 1984, and there's the old wheels start getting a bit tired, you know, and... You know, a lot of my group that I, in the dealership level, have either been promoted to either owning dealerships or running the dealership. So, the they've got younger managers in that department, and you know, so you've lost touch with the relationships that we had, and also with the introduction of the internet. And I specify that the internet has really taken away the relationship business of acquiring cars. How this is, as you would imagine, in the old days, the only tool that dealers had was a blue book, and most wholesalers would walk around with one in their back pocket and a pen and a notepad in their top pocket. And we would go to car dealers, and you know, we would try and get our foot in the door and see what they had on their lot that came in trade in the night before, and we were trying to acquire that car. And then what I used to do is fix them up and take them to the auction. So, you know, and then I moved up to the more exotic dealers, and when I had more money to buy the more expensive cars, and then I evolved into the retail from giving the opportunity of going to a Mercedes store that was getting a Porsche in trade, because they really didn't have any idea of the value. And in those days, you know, unless you were a franchise store, people wouldn't come to a Mercedes dealer to buy a Porsche, because they wouldn't know that the dealer had a Porsche, because there was no internet to direct them there. Mm-hmm. Today, the relationship business is gone, and this is why. A lot of the dealers that take a Porsche in trade today at a Mercedes store, they have the same showroom, basically, as I have, which is the internet. So they put it on their website, and they can direct everything through various lead providers to that car, because the consumer today will more than likely go to Google and, you know, punch in what he's looking to buy. And now all of a sudden you've got you know, 100 cars on one big showroom, the showroom being the internet. And it's just made it an easier place to navigate. So therefore, the dealers don't need me as much because they're more informed today. And the auction houses like Manheim have reports that today, unlike in the old days when a dealer would talk in the wholesale business, they would talk about what's wholesale blue book, what's the wholesale value on their car. And today, the only people that really use that benchmark are bankers for financing. A bank will use it. What I use is market reports. This is what cars sell for at auction. So basically, I acquire cars at auction prices, which is higher than what a dealer would give somebody for a trade-in, because what they would have to do is they would have to make a wholesale profit and they would have to pay an auction fee much higher than mine because of my relationship and the volume of cars that I run through auction. So I'm in a better position to buy that car. And furthermore, I'm buying that car because I'm going to resell it for the most part. So I'm sort of blessed by having both spectrums of the wholesale and the retail. But getting back to your question, what if I'm not around? And that's an interesting question, because I used to flip out every year when I took 2 weeks and went over to Europe or back to South Africa to visit family, and there was no cell phones or internet. My problem was I could hire the salespeople to sell all my cars, but I'd come back and my inventory would be replenished. I had to replenish my inventory. Mm-hmm. So that was a challenge. But as it is today, I've trained people in my business to know how to buy cars. People bring us cars. We have applications that we use to make the job a little easier. I've trained them how to read into the valuation, telltale signs to what to look for in a car, to try and sort of clone myself. And it is, you know, it works. Unfortunately, when I do train a lot of these people, they sort of look for greener pastures, because they either go out on their own, and I think there's probably a half a dozen guys that have either moved on and made a success story out of themselves, or others that I have told were too premature to leave have failed. But I think it is definitely a brand today where it wasn't before. It was more about Malcolm Phillips today and his relationship with the dealer. Today, it's about Phillips Auto, because I last year took a month off. I went to Europe for a month last July, and I'm proud to say that we had our very best month in July.
While you were gone.
In 10 years in July. And I tell you what, that made me feel on top of the world. So
that's great, actually.
I'm going away in August and September this year for 3 weeks to Europe. And
where are you going?
Well, I'm going to Spain. I have a lot of family now that my parents have deceased in South Africa, and I have a sister who lives in Spain, and her children have a home in Belgium. They have separate homes. They both married with families, and they have vacation homes down in the south of Spain. And then I'm sort of going on to Greece from there to a good South African friend of mine's daughter's getting married on the island of Poros. And then I'm going to go back and spend a week in London with some good South African friends of mine that live there. So I'm blessed to have friends living all over the world. So I'm a traveler, and I like to get around. So I want to have the business forever. I think it's fun and exciting. I feel that I've got really a competent group of people working for me now. I've had one of my lot attendants has been with me for 30 years. My general sales manager has been with me close to 20 years. The other manager's been with me close to 15 years, and my office staff have been with me in excess of 10 years. So we're very blessed, and it's been a wonderful journey. I'm fortunate that I came here, and I'm blessed to be living in probably one of the greatest places on the earth.
What are you looking for? What are you imparting to your employees?
Well, continue the path of success that we have given for the 34 years of being in business. And that is treating the customer with respect and stand behind what you sell. I mean, case in point, a lot of these cars that we sell, obviously we inspect them. We can't sell cars with warranties. People can purchase service contracts. And what I've done is learned that if we do sell a car and somebody didn't get a third-party inspection on it, and something expensive should go wrong with that vehicle in a timely manner, and it's to just don't run away from the client. And you probably hear these horror stories from a lot of consumers that have bought a used car. You know, there's obviously no recourse when you buy from a private party, and in most cases there's no recourse when you buy from an independent dealer or a franchise dealer for that matter. If you buy the car, you're signing an agreement that you're buying this car as is, and even such, you know, we've got everyone to sign that agreement, and even if I stuck it under their nose, I wouldn't hold my heart to it. If somebody comes across to us and I feel that they have a legitimate reason for a gripe and I can resolve the matter, I resolve the matter. I've actually gone as far as taking a car back from a young kid who's talked his father into buying a car that was highly modified. It was a Mercedes-Benz that was highly modified. And I work with people. And I'll tell you what, it's the best advertising you can do, because you do that for somebody, they come back and they'll come back again. So hopefully I've left a legacy of when I do walk away from the day-to-day operations, that I can empower my people to follow the same philosophy that I've adopted and continue to treat the customer with dignity and respect, and remember the customer's always right.
The category of car that is in demand now, or at least that you supply, and so obviously you had mentioned that Porsches are one of the big cars that you supply at the moment. Can you maybe outline for me what you think the car, what you will be supplying or what the demand will be 3 years, 5 years into the future?
Wow, I'd be a rich man if I could get my crystal ball out. I mean,
every
car enthusiast would love to have that in their bank. Here's my thought on that. Look at the production of a car. Porsche has never really been a mass-produced vehicle, and they just hold such incredible values. You know, I see people leasing these cars brand new, for example. And, you know, traditionally, a lease, these bankers that set all these residuals on new car leases, you know, have been burnt in the past. A lot of them have got out of the business. And I'm trying to answer your question with a long answer here. But it's interesting to know that if the consumer should know when it, and I've always recommended that if somebody is going to buy a new vehicle, you know, never buy a new vehicle. You lease new and you buy used. The reason is new vehicles depreciate. And generally, most vehicles will depreciate about 50% in the first 3 years. And that is evident by leases, because obviously there's a lot of three-year leases with BMW, Mercedes, Audi, Volkswagen, all these German brands. And I'm not going to mention Porsche at this time, and I'm telling you why, because there's a mass production of these cars, especially with BMW and Mercedes competing with each other in the various sectors of the market. And they are heavily subsidized, these leasing companies, I believe. I don't have my facts on this, but I believe they must be subsidized, because the amount of money they are losing at the end of the lease on these cars by going through auctions, it's horrendous. I mean, when you lease a E350 or a 5 Series BMW or a 3 Series BMW, you're really getting a low payment. It's a fantastic way to buy a new car, is to lease it. And you keep it for 3 years. But the beauty about leasing a car is it's really basically you've still got the option to buy it because they're all what they call closed-end leases. So at the end of the lease, you'd look at the residual on the vehicle. And if that residual, and in these cases that I've just mentioned, these residuals are between $5,000 and $7,000 higher than the value of the car.
Yes. Right.
So if one had to purchase their car, they would have had to absorb that depreciation in the purchase. The beauty about it is you turn it back. And to me,
in addition to paying sales tax on the car as well.
Exactly, so. Because you're not paying sales tax on the residual amount. You're only paying it on the use tax that you have. Mm-hmm. But I see people, and it breaks my heart, that have been leasing a Porsche. And I'm just reaching out to everybody out there that's leasing a Porsche today. And I'm talking about a 911.
Okay.
Never turn it back before you call me. I will put that car in my dealership, and I will write you a check at that time, because there is plenty of money over the residual. And that is leading to your question, that the Porsche depreciation is the lowest of any exotic car that is out there. Now, I'm not talking about the Ferraris and the and the Lamborghinis, because that's a whole different market. I'm just talking about a car that I'm talking about that 150 and under.
Yeah, we're not talking about like a super exotic
car. Those cars are incredible. So if I could buy every car that was turned back in lease, I wouldn't have to buy any more cars. I could make my livelihood out of just reselling those cars. So I would say the cars that I sell, the beauty about what I do is that about 60% of my business is repeat. And it makes my job a lot easier in 3 years when somebody has bought a Porsche and they bring it back, that they don't feel like they got burnt, because their trade-in value is great. And it just makes my job a lot easier, and it puts peace of mind, and they will probably continue to go down that route and buy that Porsche, or maybe step into a sport utility. And again, a Porsche would be of their preference then.
So it ultimately seems as if that if there is a mass production on that car, it generally then will be a car that will depreciate so much that if you were then to forecast into the future, that car it just won't be so much in demand for you. And specifically then what you would want to supply are those cars that are a little bit harder to obtain, and the brand of Porsche seems to be kind of more where that direction is going.
That's correct.
I had a conversation with a buddy of mine yesterday, and he was asking me what I thought about the BMW 6 Series. And I said, oh, it's a great car. And he sends me a link then to a car guru's description. So he's obviously looking at a used car. And I told him, I said, oh, you know what? I check out Phillips Auto. I'm actually meeting with the owner tomorrow. So then he had asked me, he goes, it looks like he had checked out your website. And he goes, he doesn't have a 6 Series in black on your lot. Now, I don't want you to address that specific issue, but I imagine for yourself, it would be, I'm sure you probably get more of the requests of people who are like, hey, Malcolm, you don't have the car that I'm looking for, but can you get it for me? And I'm going to presuppose that it's easier for an independent store to do that versus a franchise store. Now, regardless if you agree or disagree with that, essentially, how do you handle requests that do come to you where it's like, look, you have a buyer that's local, they see that you have a good reputation, they've been referred from a friend, but you just don't have the car that they're looking for in stock. And if, you know, now they want to request one, how do you handle these requests?
Well, that becomes a little bit more challenging now, because you've got to go to another party to acquire that car, because I can't just call the used car factory and get one of them delivered. So I'm going to have to either go to an auction, which depending on how old a car they would want. And specifically when you're talking about a 650, that's a car that has a massive depreciation on it. I mean, you know, you can really acquire one of those cars 2 years old at a greatly reduced price. Off the top of my head, I don't know, but obviously depends on the equipment that one's looking at. We can do that. And the only fear of me doing that, to be quite frank, and it's not really my business model, is because, you know, a lot of people want to feel and touch and drive the car before they buy it. And That becomes a bit challenging when I don't have the car available, which means I've got to go either through an auction, and if I go and acquire one through an auction, I pretty much will own it. And for some reason, if the buyer doesn't feel that he likes the way the car is, he might just, you know, refuse the purchase. So it gets a little trickier. So, you know, I don't have a problem selling cars. I'll be quite frank, because the quality of the cars that we sell, I've bought since I've been in business. Somebody's asked me, well, God, why don't you get involved in the sales side of the business? I said, it's not really a problem. I'm more of an acquisitions guy. And the reason I say that is, you know, since 1984, when Phillips Auto started, you know, every car that I purchased, I basically started with a stock number. And I remember starting my sequence of stock numbers at 0001. That was my first car that I bought. And then my second was 2 and 3 and 4 and 5 and so on. And, you know, currently we are at 37,000.
Man, what a treat it was to hang out with Malcolm and get to know his journey to becoming a dealer. This is definitely not going to be the last time you will hear from him. I do plan to have him back. He has just a wealth of knowledge and wisdom, too. I thought some of the key things that he was sharing with me about how he's in the acquisitions business. I think that's actually probably a critical distinction of how he's figured out how to not only survive but thrive in the independent dealer space, and specifically in the luxury market. So thanks to Malcolm for being on the show. And again, I look forward to sharing more of his voice with you all soon. And stay tuned for more dealer executives as you hear about how their dealership operation aligns with customer experience. To that end, there's also going to be a conference coming up towards the end of November called Automobility LA. This is one of the premier conferences going on in the nation, and it will kickstart the LA Auto Show. There's already some things that I have planned in talking with some companies at this event to bring to you all more content about the future of mobility and the future of automotive. So that will be pretty sweet. And as we end every episode, cheers, prost, l'chaim, kippis, nastravi, kampai, salud, mabruk, tutsints, to the customer experience.